The chair calls the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, take your seats. Chair recognizes a quorum. Members, today we have House File 10 from Representative Mohler. This is a bill for an act relating to human rights, clarifying the definition of sexual harassment. This is the only item on today's agenda. Okay, I'm allocating an entire hour and a half for this bill. We rarely do that for a bill. There's really no reason why we shouldn't be able to get this in.
Sorry, so slow.
In an hour and a half. So the first thing that we'll the bill's going to be going to the General Register. Also, I think unless you're a freshman, every single member of this committee voted for this bill on the floor twice last year. So I don't imagine that it should be that controversial, but I guess we'll see. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 6, 2019?
So moved.
Representative Carlson moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes, and the minutes of February 6 are approved. Representative Mohler, if you can begin making your way to the testifiers table. Members, the intent is that we are going to have Representative Mohler present the bill. She has some testifiers. We will do questions from those testifiers, and then we have four testifiers in opposition. There will be questions from those testifiers, and after that, there may be commentary from the public or anyone else who wants to testify on the bill, and then we'll do committee discussion, and I believe Chair Scott has an amendment. So that's what we're going to do. I am going to move us on at a pretty good clip to make sure that that we make good use of time, and we will have a vote on this bill before we adjourn at, 11:15? Yeah, so that's what we're going to do. Okay, Chair Mohler moves House File 10 to be placed on the General Register. Go ahead, Representative Mohler.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and as the Chair just said, I do move House File 10 to be placed on the General Register. House File 10 is exactly the same bill that was authored by Majority Leader Pepin last year and that all of you who were here last year voted for. This bill is necessary to ensure that workers are safe in their workplaces. As the Me Too movement has highlighted, we need to change workplace behavior. It's my understanding that this bill originated as a result of testimony that Pepin and other committee members heard as part of the Harassment and Workplace Committee that was convened last year. And what we're trying to do here, and what you did last year when you voted for this bill, is to return the law to what it was when the legislature enacted it in the 80s. Although it's not in statute, the courts have essentially asserted severe or pervasive requirement into the sexual harassment statute. In Minnesota, this has meant victims not getting their day in court, but instead having their claims rejected on summary judgment. Severe or pervasive is such a high bar that things like unwanted kissing, unwanted touching, comments like, I want to eat you, and comparing female employees' breasts are not considered severe or pervasive in our state. These facts are all from Minnesota cases where summary judgment was granted to the employer, so victims never got their day in court. And of course, we don't even know the number of victims who were told that their cases shouldn't be pursued because they would never be able to even establish that sexual harassment was severe or pervasive. And I just wanted to quote something that was in a MinnPost article last year from Majority Leader Pepin. She said, appeals in courts often end before they even begin. Lawyers talked about how they would have potential clients and they would outright tell their clients, well, this isn't enough. This is not going to even be a case, said Pepin. The severe or pervasive level makes it nearly impossible, if not impossible. We are pretty shocked by some of the cases that we read of harassing behavior that happened, and there was no opportunity for someone to have their day in court. Now, I anticipate that you're going to hear from opponents who will claim that the sky is falling with this bill, but I ask you to keep three important things in mind. First of all, an employee needs to report a claim. Second of all, for claims that an employer is unsure about, they can seek technical assistance from the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, and I specifically asked that of our human rights testifiers when they were here explaining what their job is. But most importantly, when an employer is presented with a claim, they will avoid liability if they act reasonably in response to that claim. This bill incentivizes employers to act, and if they do, they won't be liable. And finally, I would just like to note that a fiscal note was prepared and concluded that there is no fiscal impact. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have four testifiers today. And as you said, it's my understanding that all four will testify before questions are asked.
That's correct. Let's get moving, please.
Okay. Our first testifier here is Amy Schneider Kuzman.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kuzman. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amy Schneider Kuzman, and I'm here testifying in support of House File 10. Like many students, I worked as a server to put myself through school. I worked for 9 years in the industry until I graduated from law school. I never practiced law, but instead I work in sales. In my 9 years as a server, I generally worked the dinner shift until 9 or so, and then breakfast and brunch on the weekends. The restaurant did not serve alcohol. I experienced all kinds of people as a server, many very nice and respectful, some angry at who knows what, and even some who occasionally said inappropriate comments to me. But nothing in those 9 years ever rose to the level of the events that led me to contact a lawyer for help. One day in the summer of 2012, I was working a weekend morning shift, and the manager told me that some people had requested to be sat in my section. I expected to see familiar faces when I walked up to the table, but instead I saw two men that I did not recognize. I did not know them, and their comments made me feel uneasy and uncomfortable. After this encounter, the men came in every Thursday and some weekends and asked to sit in my section. This was not really typical in the industry. Not long after this, one of the men told me he had a crush on me, even though he found out I had a boyfriend. On a night that neither man came into the restaurant, I left the building at about 10 p.m. I walked to my car that was parked in the far left corner of the parking lot. I got to my car, I opened the door, and I was about to sit in it. Then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a big red truck came at me very quickly. The red truck parked right behind me, blocking me in. A man jumped out of the truck, yelling my name. He moved quickly towards me. He left the door of the truck open and the engine running. The headlights blinded me. I turned around and I saw his face. It was the man who said he had a crush on me. Two servers sprinted from the other end of the parking lot and punched and yelled at the man to stop. All three of us thought that I was about to be abducted. My heart was beating quickly and I was very frightened. Seeing who it was terrified me. I told him not to follow me to my car again. My coworker and I waited until he left the parking lot before I started home, as I was afraid that he would follow me. I reported this to management, including the general manager, and told them that I don't want to serve them anymore because I was frightened by their behavior. The managers told me that I had to serve them anyway because they requested me. Employees and managers in the restaurant even began to refer to them as my stalkers. Then the behavior of these two men escalated. Two more times they stalked me in the parking lot. I came to work one day, and the stalkers came out to meet me in the parking lot. I hurried away into the restaurant, away from them, and learned that the manager had allowed them to wait on a bench in the restaurant for 2 hours until my shift began. The manager required me to wait on them anyway. Another day, one of the men met me in the parking lot and told me he would drive by the restaurant to see if my car was there and that he knew when to come in because he now knew my work schedule. Then the behavior became more physical. Many times they would pet at my hands and arms as I put dishes onto the table. I asked them in no uncertain terms to stop, but they ignored me and did it anyway. It happened so many times that even the managers saw it happen, yet the managers did nothing. Every time they came in, I told the managers that I did not want to serve them, that we go through this every week, and I wanted to stop being made to serve them. But the managers made me anyway. They told me that if I did not serve them, then my shift would have to end. The managers routinely made me choose between being able to pay for rent and food and being sexually harassed, assaulted, and stalked, all while calling these men my stalkers. The stalkers tried to force hugs on me every time they left the restaurant. I told them no, but they always tried anyway. Many times I hid in the kitchen and asked other servers to bring my food out to my tables until they left, but they would just wait me out until I had to pick up the tables again. Twice I was already cut from the floor before the men got there, so another server waited on them. But they still wanted contact with me, so the general manager made me go to their table. He refused to give me my tips at the end of the day or let me clock out until I said goodbye to them. The manager waited at the front and watched me say goodbye to them. Each time, the manager saw them pet and tug at my arms. I was not the only person these men were harassing and assaulting. On days that I was not there, they had other young girls that they would request. The stalking and touching all happened at least once a week for over a year. That is over 50 times. Week after week, I told managers that I did not want to serve them because of the sexual harassment. I was frightened every time they came into the restaurant. It got to the point where I was most terrified when they were not even in the building because I didn't know if or when they would come in, and at least when they were there, then I could keep an eye on them, and they were less likely to show up directly behind me and catch me off guard. The trauma that these men and the managers created was ever present. It gave me nightmares, and I even called my boyfriend many times on the drive home because I was afraid that they may be following me. There was no relief, and it is still something that I did not talk about to this day. It also affected the tips that I made because I would sometimes give shifts up in fear of having to see them and actively stayed away from my other tables that were near them because I didn't want to be grabbed. Finally, I refused to leave the kitchen until they were gone, so the managers did as they threatened, and they ended my shift early. The next time the stalkers came, I refused to leave the kitchen again until they were gone. This time, the manager did talk to the two men and told them that I would not serve them anymore. Yet, management still allowed them into the restaurant. And the manager told me to keep secret the fact that he said that I would not have to serve them because the manager was afraid that he would get fired for doing so. I realized that I was still not safe because only one manager would not force me to serve them. So I had no other option than to go to the court and get an order of protection against them to keep them out of the restaurant. I gave the OFP to the general manager, yet the general manager never told the other managers that they were not allowed in the restaurant anymore. That made me realize that nothing had changed, so I sought out an attorney to protect myself and my friends that worked at the restaurant. My attorney filed a lawsuit, but nothing came of it. I never got to tell my story because the case was dismissed. The judge never heard my testimony or the testimony of my witnesses because the level of harassment that happened to me and others in the restaurant was not considered by the judge not bad enough to be illegal. It was not severe or pervasive. That barrier to justice needs to be removed. Thank you for giving me the chance to tell my story and be heard today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kuzman.
Mr. Chair, my next testifier is Sheila Engelmeyer.
Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Engelmeyer.
Thank you. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to speak. I'd like to start by noting that I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer in Minneapolis for 33 years. I represent both employees and employers. The next thing I'd like to say is thank you, Amy, for sharing your story. I, too, stand with you as someone who was sexually assaulted at work. When I was 14 years old, the owner of the small business where I worked put his hand in my dress and then in my underwear and attempted to put it in me. In the 70s, there was no sex harassment law. I didn't have the opportunity to go see a lawyer. So thank you, and me too, Amy. I'd like to ask the press to be very careful about using Amy's name. It takes great bravery to come in public and speak about things of that nature. I ask that you use her initials. Mary Palenti was the judge who arbitrated Amy's case. Mary Palenti didn't agree with the law. She didn't like the severe or pervasive standard, but she felt bound to follow it because federal courts had done so, and then after that, Minnesota courts had done so. For anyone who's on the fence on this issue, I implore you to look at the 3 hours of testimony from last year. It should help you decide what the right thing to do is, because the fact of the matter is that this legislature in 1982 got it right. In 1982, after a Continental Can case where a woman had her bottom touched many times, who was propositioned, who had her leg grabbed. She was allowed to make a claim for sex harassment as a form of sex discrimination. That was in 1980. That was before anyone on the federal level had commented in the Eighth Circuit on the issue of sex harassment. That was many years before Meritor. That was many years before Harris. Those are the U.S. Supreme Court cases on sex harassment. This legislature said we will do what they did in Continental Can. And this legislature said, and appropriately so, that sexual harassment is advances, requests for sexual favors, sexually motivated physical conduct, or other or verbal or physical conduct or communication of a sexual nature when that conduct has the purpose or effect of substantially interfering with an individual's employment, or when it creates an intimidating, hostile, or offensive employment environment. That's precisely what happened in Continental Can. That's precisely what happened in Amy's case. The only thing that's happened in the intervening time is in those 20 years, the courts have gone off the rails, and societal norms with respect to what's not okay and what people should not have to endure don't match what judges are doing on cases when they kick them out as not enough to be severe or pervasive. In front of you, you should have an article that I started writing 20 years ago on the law of severe pervasive. It caused my jaw to drop when I learned about the cases that weren't enough. And I commend to you, for 20 years, professors from Arkansas to Boston College, from Duke to California, have been writing about courts going off the rails on the issue of harassment. In 2013, a Republican-appointed judge in the Rasmussen case implored this legislature to bring the courts back on the rails, to revisit this standard and take off the brick that has been laid on top of the 1982 legislation that adds the word severe pervasive. See, the 1982 legislation codified the Continental Can case, which said nothing about severe or pervasive. It said the words that are in the statute, and they are good enough. We do not need severe or pervasive when employers who do the right thing do not have liability. Minnesota has a rich history of being ahead of the game. In 1955, a Democratic governor signed into law the first discrimination statute in the country. 9 years later, the U.S. Congress followed suit. In 1982, this legislature did the right thing. I direct your attention to page 31 of the article, footnote number 15, because this tells you clearly where we are today. This is a case in Duluth, Miller versus the University of Minnesota Duluth, Miller versus UMD. In that case, Judge Shills, a federal district court, outlines what the Eighth Circuit has said is not enough to be severe or pervasive. It is scary, members of the committee. In Rickard versus Swedish March, the court said that even though a supervisor grabbed and squeezed an employee's nipple while stating this is a form of sexual harassment, and even though that supervisor took the towel, put it to his crotch, and threw it back at the employee, that was not enough to be severe or pervasive. In McMiller versus Metro, the Eighth Circuit said that a supervisor who puts his arm around an employee's shoulder and kisses her and later called the employee to the room, locked her in, and while she was trying to get out, pulled her hand away from the door and attempted to kiss her again while grabbing her. That is not enough to be severe or pervasive. This all started with a case called Duncan, a case which Mary Valenti specifically said she disagreed with in Amy's case. In Duncan, an employee was propositioned, repeatedly touched, asked to draw an image of a penis, asked to type up the rules of the He-Man Woman Haters Club. That was not enough to be severe or pervasive. All of these cases are in this footnote. Anderson versus Family Dollar, where someone was called Baby Doll, accused of not wanting to be one of the supervisor's girls and told that she should be in bed with her boss, was not enough to be severe or pervasive. And most troublingly, in LeGrand, a male supervisor told his male employee Let's watch pornographic movies together. Let's masturbate together. You will advance if you bring me to orgasm. And he kissed this employee on the mouth. He grabbed the employee's butt. He brushed up against the employee's groin. He reached for the employee's genitals and grabbed his legs. That was not enough to be severe or pervasive. Societal norms do not tolerate this court's shift away from what the societal norms were that were outlined in Continental Canon and were adopted by this body in 1982. Here's where we are, members of the committee. Reject the court's rock on top of that statute. 4 months after this committee heard this matter on April 26, 2018, the Delaware legislature, Delaware, the state that has the most pro-business statutes in the country, everyone incorporates there because of that. Delaware upped its game on the issue of sex harassment. We must take this rock off this statute. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Engelmeyer.
Mr. Chair, my next testifier is Leslie Lineman. Oh, sorry, excuse me, Megan Peterson.
Thank you. Ms. Peterson, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman Lash and members of the committee. My name is Megan Peterson. I'm the Executive Director of Gender Justice, a nonprofit legal and policy advocacy organization devoted to addressing the causes and consequences of gender inequality. Part of our mission includes combating sexual harassment in the workplace and the many ways gender bias creates power imbalances that allow harassment to continue. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you all today in support of House File 10 to clarify the definition of sexual harassment, to lower barriers to justice for more Minnesotans, and to empower employers to fully extinguish sexual harassment from their workplaces. I also want to thank everyone who was here last year, all the members who supported the same bill last year. As a legal organization, we have represented several victims of sexual harassment over the past 9 years. We have represented both women and men. Our clients have turned to us after they failed to secure relief through their employer and found no other recourse than to seek justice through the courts. Our clients' experiences, as well as the stories of the brave women and men who have come forward as part of the Me Too movement, demonstrate that sexual harassment remains a widespread problem. It is a problem that disproportionately affects women and is even more pronounced at the intersection of race, gender, disability, and class. Sexual harassment damages its victims' career development and future earnings. It contributes to unequal pay and status and effectively denies them an equal opportunity to succeed and provide for their families. 2 out of 3 women in Minnesota report that they have personally experienced sexual harassment, and more than a quarter of all charges filed with the EEOC include sexual harassment or discrimination claims. But this is only the tip of the iceberg. The vast majority of people who experience sexual harassment at work never take legal action. Most don't even discuss the problem with a manager. They're right to be reluctant, unfortunately. Far too often, employees who speak out against workplace mistreatment report facing some kind of retaliation. Employers may dismiss or minimize the problem or respond with outward hostility toward the victim. Adding insult to injury, when survivors of sexual harassment have turned to state courts for help, as you've already been hearing today, their claims have too frequently been dismissed based on the federal severe or pervasive threshold. This legal test has never been a part of Minnesota law, and it flies in the face of common sense. Reasonable people know what harassment looks like when they see it. But in just 3 words, the severe pervasive test compromises the dignity of working people and violates our values as Minnesotans. Employees have a right to expect that they will have a workplace free of harassment and discrimination and to be given a fair chance to succeed. Removing this too strict federal threshold will bring state law in line with reasonable workplace expectations, establish a clear legal framework for employers, and go a long way toward ensuring equality in the workplace. Fixing the problem of sexual harassment will require change on many levels, but this bill is one of the most meaningful and powerful solutions we have. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, my next testifier is Leslie Lineman.
Thank you, Ms. Lineman. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Lieneman. I am an attorney in Minnesota and have been since 1992. I'm the president of the Employee Lawyers Association of Minnesota, which is an affiliate of the National Employment Lawyers Association. That means I'm a plaintiff's lawyer. I represent victims of sexual harassment in Minnesota. And I would like to address what I believe is the opposition to this bill, which is that this bill will allow floodgates to open and there will be claims over innocuous behavior, or that we will have no standard if we decline to follow the federal severe or pervasive standard. But the truth is that the legislature defined this standard in 1982. It's not about innocuous conduct. The statute already requires the conduct that is prohibited to be sexually motivated conduct or physical or verbal conduct of a sexual nature that has the purpose or effect of substantially interfering with the employee's ability to do his or her job or creating a hostile, offensive, or intimidating work environment. We have a standard. It is the Continental CAN standard, and we are not without guardrails here. More importantly, the floodgate argument talks about the cost of litigation, but what gets lost is the cost of sexual harassment in the workplace to business. Yes, I think we're all aware of the cost to these women who are being harassed. But what happens in a business when women are being harassed and it's not dealt with is people quit and they seek unemployment benefits, requiring the employer to rehire and retrain. Or they try to avoid the harassment by calling in sick, taking medical leaves, hiding in the kitchen, hiding in the parking lot, getting the other employees to do the job, avoiding job assignments. These are all things that take away from productive employment functions that are what they're supposed to be there to do, not to mention the fact that sexually harassing employees are engaging in conduct that is sexual harassment rather than engaging in the conduct they were hired to do. So the bottom line is that sexual harassment that occurs in the workplace is very bad for business, and businesses spend a lot of time on that when they're not dealing with it appropriately. It is also important to note that floodgates will not open on sexual harassment because you remove the severe or pervasive standard, because employers have the ability to govern their destiny here. If they have policies and they appropriately train their employees, if they take reasonable action to address harassment in the workplace, they will not be held liable, regardless of the standard that we have now about what constitutes sexual harassment. There is something that occurred a couple weeks ago that I think this committee should know about, which is a Court of Appeals opinion in the Kenna case. We talked about this last year quite a bit, but essentially what happened is the Court of Appeals said that they felt compelled to adopt this federal severe or pervasive standard, including all of the cases that my colleague just discussed. 2 weeks ago, the Minnesota Court of Appeals said, you may not like this standard, we may not like it, but if the legislature doesn't like it, it's the legislature's job to change it. What that means is that the conduct you've just heard described right now is not illegal in Minnesota. What that means is that women are expected to tolerate that level of harassment with no recourse. That's the state of the law. I have heard the comment that this bill is a bridge too far. Well, that's only true if you believe the status quo is acceptable. If it is acceptable to you that this conduct is legal in the workplace, then you need do nothing. But if what has been described to you is not acceptable conduct in the workplace, if it's not acceptable to you, the legislature, that women must deal with being groped, grabbed, sexually propositioned, and forced to work with harassing employees, if that's not acceptable to you, then the bridge too far is the severe or pervasive standard, and I ask that you change it. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lieneman. Now we're going to do some questions. Rep. Mueller, anything else before we do questions?
That's correct, Chair.
Okay, we're going to do questions for pro-testifiers. My first question is... I have a question, actually, for Ms. Kuzman. What was the restaurant that happened at? Can you say that? I mean, I want to know. Perkins. Golden Valley Perkins. Okay, thank you. Other questions? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this question would go to that same testifier. Just have one brief question for her, Amy Schneider-Kunzman. Just real quickly. Thanks for coming back up. I can't believe that nothing was done. I can't believe the employers did nothing on your behalf. It's deplorable, disgusting, all that. But I was curious, especially with the situation out in the parking lot where you felt like they were going to abduct you. Did you contact law enforcement about that situation, or ever were they ever involved in this? I just feel like that would have taken my breath away so badly that I would have been calling the cops. But I don't know what your thoughts were. And you had witnesses, too, at that time.
Yes, I did. I was just in so much shock, I think. But, I mean, then in terms of law enforcement, then I got the OFP. But other than that, no.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all I had for you. I was just curious about that. And I think to the Mr. Chair, the testifier that went just a minute ago, just the last one, I don't think that anyone around this table is saying that severe pervasive is a perfect standard. I think there's room for improvement. Our question is, and I voted for this thing last year. I gave it a hearing, but it was at the end of session. It was after deadline, if I remember correctly. And I think we're learning more. And I've actually had a chance to read some of the cases that have been decided. And so I don't think that anyone here is saying that severe or pervasive is the perfect standard. We're just not sure that going back to what's in current law is the correct standard, that it's high enough. And I'll speak to my amendment in a little bit just about the word offensive being enough to bring a suit. One of the things that I think, too, is important to bring out is we don't know, there's no data kept on how many cases settle out of court before they ever get to summary judgment, anything. And I don't know if any of you have any data on that or not, but I've been unable to find any data on that. So I don't know if any of the testifiers can testify to
the reason.
Ms. Lehman.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair. The reason that I suspect you're unable to find that data is that most settlements are confidential.
Right.
And so plaintiff's side and defense side attorneys are not able to provide that information other than what is available through the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. They do publish a report each year indicating how many of their charges are resolved. But there is no compilation that I'm aware of that would offer that information. With respect to the issue of the word offensive, I think the word offensive is modified by the statute itself, which requires it to be physical or verbal conduct of a sexual nature when that conduct creates an offensive work environment. And so it's not the word offensive floating out there alone. If you read it in the context of the statute, it still must be physically motivated sexual conduct or physical conduct or other verbal or communication of a sexual nature that creates an offensive environment. So I believe there is context there that allows the standard to be effective as it was originally written.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would go to Ms. Engelmeyer. Let me get my bearings about me here. Well, go ahead to the next person, and I'll find the question I had for you.
Your next question is from Representative Robbins. And keep in mind, folks, you have questions of these people, that business interests, the Chamber, I think independent businesses, Chamber of Commerce, and I don't know who else, are going to be testifying next. So some of your questions might be answered by those. So Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Thank you especially to Ms. Kuzman for coming and for your courageous testimony. I'm sorry for all you've been through, and I think all of us here want to make sure that cases like that are heard. And so I'm a freshman, and I was not part of this last year. Sorry. And so my question is, it's been mentioned several times that if the employer acts correctly, that they are not liable. But I do not see that in this statute, and I wonder where you're getting that from, and if you're just importing common law, reasonable standard, and totality of the circumstances standard, or where that comes from.
Ms. Who's that for, Representative? Robbins?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Okay, Ms.
Whoever would like
Engelmeyer.
It.
Sure. So,
Ms. Engelmeyer, can you pull the mic a little bit?
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
So when the statute was enacted in 1982, there was a standard of knew or should have known and failed to take appropriate action. In 2000, the statute was amended, and the legislative history of the amendment in 2000 said that the legislature was intending to adopt the federal law as it relates to the issue of what is a defense. So the defense is, if you're dealing with a supervisor and it results in tangible employment action, there is no defense. So you have to train your supervisors well enough to not be the bad actors. If it is peer-on-peer, then it's a knew or should have known standard. If you knew or should have known and failed to take appropriate action, if it is a supervisor that doesn't result in tangible employment action, the employer has a defense if it takes all reasonable steps to correct and prevent, and if the employee failed to avail themselves of a remedy under the law. That's the current status of the law. That was specifically addressed in the legislative history in 2000.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, ma'am. And that's in the current statute?
It's not in the statute right now.
And
okay, Representative Robbins.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes. So that's very concerning to me that it's not laid out in the statute. So I would hope that we would consider specifying something like that. I think that there was a case, in preparing for this hearing, I came across a case from 1986 from the Eighth Circuit here, Moylan versus Marys, and they also had as a test the employer should or knew or should have known and failed to take proper remedial action. And I think specifying that in the statute would alleviate some of the concern about when the liability kicks in.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the first question is essentially a follow-up to that. So I'm still not clear. Where is the affirmative defense listed then if it's not statute? Where did you get that from?
Ms. Engelmeyer.
So as you, in the article that I provided to you, the Moylan case was the first case, and it goes on through the current cases today. There are dozens of cases over that time period that have specifically said all the part of the statute that is here is defining what sex harassment is. It doesn't define when the employer is liable. That is defined by case law. So we're saying this definition of what sex harassment is okay. And the case law takes care of when an employer is liable for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so it's common law then is where the defenses come in, and that makes sense. Okay, and I echo the concerns, and I think that that's an opportunity for us to perhaps codify that into statute, something for us to consider. The next question I have would be for the bill author. The language here, it says the effective date is August 1st of 2019. Could you explain how allegations that occurred prior to that date, if this were enacted into law, how would allegations prior to that date play out in terms of the new language?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, and I listened to the committee hearing from last year, and there was quite a bit of testimony on this effective date. And so it's my intent and my understanding that because of the effective date, it's only applying to claims that are occurring on or after that date. And so we would still be applying the severe or pervasive standard for cases for claims that would arise prior to that date. And that's my understanding. I would ask the experts to verify that.
Ms. Engelmeyer?
Thank you.
Ms. Lederman.
So typically, unless a statute specifically says it's intended to apply retroactively, it does not apply retroactively.
Okay. Did you have another question, Representative
Lederman? I do.
Okay.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, just to make sure I'm clear then, so if the claim or the allegation is after this date, but it's in reference to an event that took place before the date, that would not be covered by the new language, is what you're saying?
Well, okay.
Ms. Engelmeyer.
Thank you very much. I apologize, Mr. Chair. Let's be sure. This language does not contain severe or pervasive. So typically, on the issue of retroactivity, the facts have to accrue after the date that it becomes effective. Do you follow what I'm saying? So it would be after all facts that accrue after August 1.
Not just the claim. Okay, thank you.
Correct.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Lesh. First of all, to Ms. Guzman, more of a comment. It's appalling what you went through. And nobody should have to go through that. And I don't, my family owns a small, my father-in-law owns a small business. If we had an employee that was going to, we've actually trespassed people out of our businesses for acting like that. Nobody should have to go through that. The employee who, or the managers that refused to do that should have been terminated immediately. But I guess it comes back to another question I have. Because I have my family owns a small business, I just want to make sure there's some protections for the employers who hire the people and help them make a living. Is there any protections in the statute, not common law, but in the statute to protect the employers who actually are doing the right thing and trying to do things and protect the employers from other suits for terminating an employee who violates these laws?
Ms. Engelmeyer.
Thank you. Well, here's how I view this definition. If an employer takes action to stop behavior, it doesn't become substantially interfering. It doesn't become an intimidating, hostile environment. If the employer does the right thing, and when they learn, the statute itself says if you stop it before it becomes that environment, it's not harassment. So if it's not harassment, there is no claim. So if an employer is doing the right thing, training like this legislature is doing this year, doing the right thing, investigating, looking into it, not looking the other way like happened to Amy not that long ago, then we don't get to meeting the threshold that's already in the statute. We don't need the severe or pervasive brick on top of the statute for employers to have that defense.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, follow-up?
I have a couple of follow-ups.
Well, Chair Johnson, here's the deal. We're at 10:30. We did 26 minutes for proponent testimony. We're now moving on to 15 minutes of Q&A. I know that the opponents want more time than the proponents. I'm going to try to do that, but we're at the point where I can't because we need deliberative time for Chair Scott's amendment, for committee deliberative time, and the vote. So if it's really important, go ahead.
One thing, I just bring up one last thing. I'm just wondering what the definition of severe and persuasive is that the judges are using, because the story that she had, any reasonable person would think that's severe and persuasive. Do we need to reteach our judges on what severe and persuasive is?
Okay, thank you. Do you have it? Did Ms. Lindemann or Ms. Engelmeyer have a very brief follow-up to that you can do in a sentence? Like it's up to the jury?
The courts have said it must be hellish.
Okay.
This law doesn't contemplate hellish.
Hey, Chair Lesh, this what Ms. Guzman went through was hellish.
Thank you. Keeping in mind what I told Chair Johnson, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. So there's been some discussion about the common law importation of reasonable person or totality or other common law standards. And I just want to clarify on that because I'm not a lawyer. My understanding is that if it's not specified in the statute, it would be strict liability. There is no common law accepting that the case law just is adopted because it's out there. Is that not correct?
Ms. Engelmeyer?
In this Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Freiler, the Minnesota Supreme Court was posed that specific question, and they said no.
Okay.
No strict liability.
on this issue?
Correct. Specifically on this issue, making the very argument that you just raised, that if it's not in the statute, it must mean strict liability, and they said absolutely not.
That's why we have experts. Okay, Rep. Mueller. Yes, some of you, you wanted to get on the list, but...
No, I'm good.
Okay, thank you. Opponents, come on down here and get ready. First one is going to be either Melissa Raffan or Catherine Nash, and I'm sorry if I butchered your name. How do you say that? Raffan? People always butcher my name, so they're going to have a little license to butcher some other people's names. They say leash, lush, whatever. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Catherine Nash. I'm an attorney at Gray Plant Moody. I chair the Labor, Employment, and Higher Education Practice. I am here on behalf of myself. I am not representing any interest group. I spend the majority of my practice working on the area and the important issues around sexual harassment. I am employed, often hired by businesses, higher education institutions. This is a topic I care deeply about. I agree with the majority of the comments made today. I applaud you all for taking this issue so seriously. Something does need to be done. I don't disagree. I'm not going to stand up here, rather sit up here, and defend some of those cases that were cited this morning, because they should have met a standard. My concern is that this proposed amendment is not the solution and will have unintended consequences. I had the opportunity early this morning to listen to much of the committee hearing last year. I was not here for that. And it became clear to me that many individuals were really looking at the number of cases that survived summary judgment as a measure to see, is the standard appropriate? And I just want to take a brief moment to talk about how these cases often come to be. An employee or a student is unhappy with something that happened, and many times it may be for good reason, and they initiate a charge or a lawsuit. And I then often will get a call and am talking with my client about how should we respond to this. And if there are instances in which the facts are not good, the institution, the employer did not do the right thing, the conduct was not good, then we are often talking very early about settling that case. And so many of the cases with very bad, egregious facts don't ever make it to summary judgment. The cases that do make it to summary judgment are often cases that employers feel they have done the right thing and the conduct wasn't sufficiently severe or pervasive. We've heard cases that should have met that standard today, I would agree. But there are many, many cases that should have been dismissed on summary judgment because the incidents were not enough. They were not pervasive enough. They were not sexual enough in nature. And so I am concerned about the unintended consequences. This statute applies not just in the context of employment. It applies in the context of higher education. I work with higher education institutions on a very regular basis. Most of the work I do is on the prevention side. I'm training people around the country, students, employees, supervisors, on civil and respectful workplaces, civil and respectful education environments. Most institutions, most companies want to do the right thing. I agree with the comments about the cost of harassment. It is significant. There is good business reasons to be responding, not when it gets to a level of severe or pervasive, but we want to nip these things in the bud. And so thinking about applying this law in the higher education context where it would apply 24/7, students live on campus, a single offensive comment made that is sexual in nature could bring rise to claims. So a roommate comes in, their roommate is watching an HBO television show. It's not pornography, it's something that you might find offensive. And that individual could make a claim and say, that was offensive to me. And so I feel like we need some standards, and I'm going to let Ms. Raffan talk a little bit more about those, but I wanted to just share a little bit more about some of the unintended consequences I fear if we remove this. I think there are other ways to address this, and we should work together. This is one of those unique circumstances in which you all of you good people, can come together and work on a bipartisan solution, because no one is for harassment. Right? I don't think anyone in this room, none of us testifying today, we don't want harassment. I don't want it in my workplace. I don't want it in any workplace. I spent a lot of time trying to prevent that. But I am concerned that this solution is the wrong solution. I think it could have the unintended consequence of less people reporting. Because if people fear that companies, businesses, higher education institutions are going to have a knee-jerk reaction and respond swiftly and harshly to any kind of offensive comments, we could be suspending students, we could be terminating employment. And people say, I don't think I want my friend to get suspended. I mean, it wasn't okay what he or she said, so I'm not going to say anything because I'm afraid that's going to be the consequence, because businesses and institutions are so fearful of these lawsuits coming. I also want to caution you that whatever standard you apply, and I know much of these efforts are intended to protect women, and I am all for that, but these same standards can be used against women. If the standard is too low, and I've seen this happen in higher education situations where we see cross complaints coming, and people who are truly victims are now finding themselves defending themselves against allegations using those standards. And so those are some of the concerns that I share with you today. I just really want to emphasize that I think employers share these concerns with you. They are investing money and time in trying to do training and have good policies, and they aren't training on how to not be severe or pervasive. They are training on how to have respectful workplaces, because we agree that's where we should be at.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Nash. Ms. Raffin, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Melissa Raffan, and I've been a partner in the employment law community for 30-plus years. I'm familiar with the attorneys who testified this morning. I've been across the table from them. I have a lot of respect for them, and I am very pleased to be here, and I thank you for your time. My concern about the testimony of the proponents is that it inaccurately frames the issue. As Ms. Nash said, this is not about are you for sexual harassment or are you against sexual harassment. The employer community is very committed to proactively ridding the workplace of sexual harassment, and when it learns that it has occurred, of taking prompt remedial action. The supervisor that Ms. Guzman described this morning is a supervisor who clearly didn't understand the law or chose to ignore the law. But the point is, it wouldn't have mattered what the law was. That was what he did. And so that shouldn't be the employer community that you are thinking about as you consider this proposed amendment. The issue really is, what is the solution? And I commend Ms. Nash for saying that it does call for a bipartisan solution. Our concern really is the language that's at issue, and a number of questions were raised that touch on the employer's community concern. I should back up and say that I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Employment Law Council, the employer community, and the employer community. A number of the issues that have raised this morning resonate with the employer community. The question is how best to address it. Now, a statement was made that we are going to contend that the sky is falling. And I would have to say, I think the sky is falling probably fell more to the proponents than the opponents. We're not here to say the sky is falling. We're here to say we have tremendous concerns about the language that is being proposed, because it will increase the amount of litigation. There's just no question about that. And I think the points Ms. Nash made about it having a chilling effect on people coming forward is a good one, because the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission itself, in its 2016 task force report, noted that zero tolerance policies are not good for the workplace, because they often invoke knee-jerk reactions that for which everyone pays a huge price. Now, employers are trying to do the right thing, and the workplace is full of, you know, there's training, there's computer training, there's live training, there are policies, there are workshops, there is coaching, there is counseling. There's a myriad and a continuum of tools and resources that employers call on to make sure that they can, in the words of Leslie Linneman, govern their own destiny. But allowing for subjective language to be the governing of the workforce would be problematic. The United States Supreme Court, in the case of, I think it's Oncal versus Sundowner, said, Title VII is not meant to be a civility code. That is not in any way, shape, or form meant to say that anyone can say or do anything in the workplace. What it really says is people can't choose who they work with. People come to the workplace with different backgrounds, from different geography, different socioeconomic classes, and it really is a melting pot. And there is going to be some level of conduct, some comment, that someone is going to make that you may find offensive that should not be actionable. And making every word actionable is the concern that we have. Now, because of how case law works, if we eliminated severe or pervasive and had the statement of legislative intent to go back to the original language of the statute, it would eliminate all other reasonable rules that have developed for handling these cases. So the reasonable person standard. There is a two-level inquiry that is employed today in these cases. It is whether a reasonable person would have found the conduct offensive, and then whether it is you, did you find the conduct offensive? What's nice about that two-level inquiry is there's an objective component. So if you're overly sensitive, the issue is going to be knocked out because a reasonable person wouldn't have found it offensive. But then there is the inquiry, did you find it offensive? That two-level inquiry is a critical guardrail in this arena. In addition, there's a totality of the circumstances standard, another guardrail that is critical in this arena. The current amendment does not account for the substantial interference language in both parts of the statute. So there is language, if you read the proposed amendment carefully, it says that conduct that has the effect of creating an offensive environment, meaning subjective offensive conduct, would be the standard for sexual harassment claims under the MHRA, and that is completely unworkable. Now, there was commentary that employers will not be liable if they act reasonably, but it's not in the statute. And there was a question about it, which I think was really an excellent question. If the idea truly is to eradicate sexual harassment from the workplace and not simply punish employers when it occurs, then the employers who do the right thing should be allowed to avoid liability, because that's what you're trying to do, is incent them to do the right thing, and that should be written in the statute as was proposed. That is very critical. We are here to talk about, we remain ready to talk about language that would be acceptable to address an issue that is of concern. Our concern simply is the language that is being proposed to address an issue that we all agree is an issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Rafan. Next testifier, Mike Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey, National Federation of Independent Business. The clock's running here. I'm going to make a couple of brief comments and yield my time to Kurt Erickson. We're very concerned about this bill, just as we were last year. We represent about 10,000 small businesses, and we're very concerned about small business liability, a big increase in cases. A lot of small businesses are not properly insured for this. They have liability insurance, but they won't specifically have EPLI, Employer Practice Liability Insurance. They will not be covered for these types of claims. Kurt Erickson and his colleagues have told me that if you cannot reach a settlement, these kind of claims can easily cost $50,000 to $250,000 or greater, and this could be enough to bankrupt some small businesses, cause significant financial harm to other small businesses. So we're very concerned about that. We're very concerned about an increase in cases. We're very concerned that this bill is taking the standard that every court in this country, federal and state, has used since 1986, and wiping it out and not replacing it with a replacement standard. And there's a real concern there. And I think we're going to have a lot of unintended consequences and negative consequences. And finally, I just want to mention, last summer I reached out to a lot of experienced practitioners in this area and one law professor, trying to find out just how bad are the Minnesota case law versus the federal. And we could come up with very few Minnesota cases. The one that got a lot of mention was a terrible case up in Two Harbors, Rasmussen versus Two Harbors Fish Company, and a bad district court ruling was overturned by the Court of Appeals. It was overturned by the Supreme Court, and a large judgment was issued in favor of the plaintiffs. And but we found very few state cases. It seems, based on just the very experienced people I've talked to, that the Minnesota jurists have interpreted severe and pervasive in a better manner, in a more reasonable manner than federal jurists have. And I'm going to yield the rest of my time to Kurt Erickson.
Mr. Erickson, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kurt Erickson. I'm a lawyer at Littler Mendelson, practicing in labor and employment law, generally on the management side. Let me segue directly into what Mike talked about, which was cases from Minnesota. And let me hearken you back to the hearing back in April of 2018. One of the things that was asked during that hearing was for follow-up with regard to cases by Minnesota interpreting the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And what I did at that time on April 27th was I forwarded to then-chair, now ranking member Scott, and to representative ranking member Lesh and now chair Lesh, 8 different cases from the Minnesota courts interpreting the Minnesota Human Rights Act and specifically interpreting severe and pervasive in a much more, for lack of a better way to say it, reasonable light. And the cases included, so specifically dealing with Minnesota cases, dealing with the Human Rights Act, dealing with severe or pervasive, and finding either that the conduct, whether it was collective or singular, whether it was severe or pervasive, was either actionable or required a trial. And those cases that I sent to those two representatives back in April of 2018 included the Petrovic versus Ridgeview case, the Devane versus Sears Home Improvement case, the Gagliardi versus Ortho Midwest case, where the Minnesota Court of Appeals specifically outlined various cases where a singular incident, not a series of incidents, but a singular incident could amount to actionable harassment under the severe standard. And it also included the Orth versus College of St. Catherine case and the Hansen versus Regency Corp case. These are all cases by Minnesota courts interpreting the Minnesota Human Rights Act and doing so in a manner that allowed sexual harassment claims to go forward on many of the things that we were talking about here today. Many of the issues that have been raised today deal with federal court cases interpreting federal law. And the problem with that, for purposes of dealing with our statute, is that we don't have any control by the Minnesota legislature in terms of what a federal court is going to do in interpreting federal law. What we can do, and what the Minnesota courts have done, is interpret the Minnesota Human Rights Act in, for lack of a better way to say it, a much more employee-friendly manner. And that's the history. The first case was from Hansen versus Regency Corp from 1996. The most current case, as Mike talked about, was the Rasmussen versus Two Harbors case. Those are all cases in which these types of incidents have gone forward and been allowed to go to a fact finder for a determination. Since that time, the Minnesota Human Rights Act has been further broadened to allow for jury trials. So I would say that the chances that we're going to have this type of behavior allowed under the Minnesota Human Rights Act in comparison to what the federal courts are doing under Title VII has been substantially lessened. And I think that's the reality. And I don't hear any response in terms of what the Minnesota cases are. When I look over my colleague Sheila Engelmeyer's brief 30 pages, I see a lot of federal court cases, but that isn't what we're here for. What we're here to talk about is amending the Human Rights Act, not amending Title VII with regard to that. And that's what we have to deal with. And Mike is exactly right with regard to the consequences of this. The consequences of this are it will drive up the cost of insurance for all employers purchasing employers' practice liability insurance. It will make those companies, which are small, many of whom are represented by Mike, and don't have insurance at all, it will expose those companies to these types of claims. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Erickson, we have a list of questions. On the list, Representative Noor Cantrell, Carlson, O'Neill, Hassan, Liebling. We want time to take and consider Chair Scott's amendment. Also deliberate and vote on the bill. So with that in mind, Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Ms. Nash.
Go ahead, ask your question while she's making her way up here,
right, Representative Noor. You say that if a college student walks into a dorm room and their roommate is watching a HBO show, you'll find that offensive. That's an actionable claim under HF10. But what about element 1 and 2? Does that HBO show constitute a term or conditions? Does that HBO show constitute a factor in decisions?
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So the statute is it's 1, 2, or 3. And so if it satisfies number 3, that alone would be enough.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the only question I have.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rafan, would you mind?
Go ahead, ask your question while she's making her way up here, Representative Cantrell.
So you said that this issue needs to be bipartisan, and I agree. It was bipartisan last year when Majority Leader Pepin authored it, and a couple of Republican members authored this provision as well. So my question is, what's happened in the last year that this is no longer bipartisan?
Ms. Rafan.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This language that is being proposed in House File Number 10 is not language that has the buy-in of the employer community for the simple reason that it's unworkable. And if I can just direct your attention to the question, to the language that responds to the previous question, if you look at number 3, as Ms. Nash said, number 3 stands on its own. And it says that conduct or communication has the purpose or effect of substantially interfering with an individual's employment, public accommodations, or public services, education, or housing, or creating an intimidating, hostile, or offensive employment, public accommodations, public services, educational, or housing environment. Meaning that conduct or communication that is offensive is problematic. And that is a significant concern. So this language contained in House File Number 10 does not have the support of the employer community.
President Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rafan. So what solutions would you offer then so that we can remedy this?
I think that's
Ms. Rafan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. That is an excellent question. And the solution we are seeking is the opportunity to sit down with both sides and work on language that would be acceptable, that would allow for the language that everyone's talking about to have guardrails, to have an objective standard that everyone can agree on, to allow for employers who do the right thing to not be held liable under the statute. There are a number of concepts that we'd like to work into the statute, and we welcome the opportunity to sit down and discuss it with both sides.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. I'm gonna pass and save my comments for the end.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've been listening intently to both sides, and I'm so confused. And I was a huge supporter of this coming through before. We obviously want to do the right thing. I might personally have been horribly sexually harassed in my own work environment that led me to horrible suicidal thoughts. I've been in very dark places because of it. This is very personal to me. But the opponents and proponents are saying opposite things. They're all lawyers. They're all saying things, and it's just very confusing. And so one of the things that is incredibly important, and I would like maybe nonpartisan staff to clarify for us, because we are making some really big decisions, the question is, what applies and what doesn't apply? So the reasonable person standard and the totality of circumstances standards, even though it's not specifically in this part of statute, can they at least speak to that part? Because the opponents and proponents are saying completely opposite things about whether those standards would apply if we remove severe or pervasive, which has been misstated multiple times at this committee hearing. It's not and. So I have that question. And then I do take issue with Ms. Rafan's comment.
Me too.
Because I find it disingenuous when she said the Perkins manager, quote, did not follow the law. And yet Mary Pawlenty threw it out. Judge Mary Pawlenty threw it out because it didn't meet the standard of severe or pervasive. So I find that very conflicting. I just wanted to point that out as well. But if we could have nonpartisan staff at least clarify whether or not these standards would apply if we remove severe or pervasive, which would be reasonable person in totality of circumstances. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Mullins, is this your department? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair and members. When there's case law that is problematic and that the legislature intends to fix, you know, you see those bills a lot. The objective is usually to do the minimal amount of changes to the statute in order to overturn the decision or redirect the courts, but not to change the language entirely. And so you see those fixes a lot. They've done this at the federal level in the ADA, and they've also done it in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. They don't completely rewrite the statute or import every single standard that is in the case law. They usually just make a small change. I can't believe that the courts would abandon all of the existing case law because they've been directed to use a lower standard. It seems like a very unlikely result. But when the courts go to interpret new language, they're going to look at the legislative history. So it's very important that the author of the bill and that the legislature, as it debates it, is very clear about what the intention is. And if the intention is not to abandon those other standards, that should be put on the record and, you know, supported by the author.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you say put on the record, so if the author was to state the author's intent, even if it wasn't written into the statute as such, that would be sufficient, because I do know that the court will review these, you know, as they go through case law, and they're kind of creating new case law in a sense. They will look at what we're saying today and actually weigh it in their decisions. And so is that what you're referring to?
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, that is generally when they look at the legislative intent, they look at a number of different things, but they certainly do look to what the legislature and the members were actually saying in the debate. Yes.
Thank you. Although apparently that didn't work for the 1982 legislation. Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Chair. My first comment is to Ms. Nash and Ms. Raffin. I disagree with you guys. You both said this isn't about, no one is for sexual harassment. I'm reading a report here that says in 2016, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission reported that 85% of women reported that they were sexually harassed in the workplace. So are we going to continue saying that boys are going to be boys and allow women to be harassed? Your testimony is disappointing because the first testimony about the Perkins, that was explicit harassment, of grabbing, touching, offering sexual favors to a person. And you guys sit here and say that you are not for sexual harassment, yet you listen to that and you washed it off with saying that HBO show. How is that even, how are the two cases even close to one another? To HBO show, a student watching an HBO show, and someone being harassed, grabbed, called names, almost kidnapped. And the report that I'm just giving you, 85% of women are sexually harassed in the workplace. So we need employers to act up. I don't care if it bankrupts, if this bankrupts, and the other two guys, one of them said that it's going to bankrupt small businesses. Well, a small business needs to teach boys to stop harassing women. It's time to act. It's 2019. We cannot continue doing the same things and expecting change. So I don't know who you represent, but if I was the business that you represent today, I would be ashamed. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, thanks for giving me that act to follow. Wow, yeah. I just simply wanted to make a comment as well, and I'll be really brief. You know, Ms. Raffan and Ms. Nash both talked about we need bipartisan solutions, and Representative Cantrell mentioned this before. You know, this is a bipartisan solution, and I really, there is something going on here where people come in a year after testifying on this bill, and I understand that Ms. Raffan testified on this bill a year ago, and now comes in and says, we want to work together. Why don't you guys work together? We've had a year. And the fact is that when this bill was here before, it received 121 votes on the House floor. If that isn't bipartisan, I don't know what is. It was carried by the Republican Majority Leader, Joyce Pepin. And she was very committed to this bill and worked on it very, very hard and was extremely disappointed that it didn't go any further. So that is bipartisanship. This is a bipartisan bill. And just because the business community now comes in and says we don't like it, that doesn't make it partisan. That just means the business community, or I should say some of the business community, is opposing the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Chair Lash. My question is actually for Mike Hickey. So I'll wait before he comes, as he comes down. I'm just going to
say. Come on down, Mr. Hickey. Go ahead, ask your question while he's making way.
Yes, and I just want to say thank you to Rep. Moeller for reaching for a Republican bill that was good and for bringing this back and something that had bipartisan support. So thank you for doing that. My question for Mr. Hickey is that you stated in your testimony that Minnesota applies a better standard than federal courts. Can you please point to any Minnesota decisions that actually say that?
Okay, Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I didn't say that. I said the Minnesota jurists appear, based on all the outreach I did, the very experienced practitioners, the Minnesota jurists appear to apply the standard more reasonably. They're still using the same standard. This is the national precedent that's guided every court in this country since 1986. That's what you're contemplating changing today. And the Rasmussen case certainly is clear evidence of that. This bad district court decision was overturned by the Minnesota Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court in a large, I believe, 312, actually I have the exact number, $312,000 judgment was issued for the plaintiff.
Representative Herr.
I just want to actually just ask for a point of clarification then, because when you say it appears versus that, I guess what informs that appears, I want to have something concrete to say. What are all of the things that would actually create a situation in which then the appearance is that that is the case, right? So I don't know if there's more information that you can share to really inform that for me.
Mr. Hickey, do you want to get that information to her offline maybe if it gets complicated? I mean, that's probably more appropriate.
I was going to say I'm happy to.
Hold on a second. Mr. Erickson, I don't think a question was asked to you, but but quick clarification, 10 seconds, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm happy to forward the emails that I sent to you and Representative Scott last year, which talk about the cases directly answering the representative's question.
Okay, thank you. Is that adequate, Representative Herr? Thank you. Representative Considine, do you have a quick comment before? Okay. Chair Scott, to your amendment, the A1, do you want to offer that?
I would, Mr. Chair. I did have some questions, and I don't... I guess I'm having a hard time understanding what the rush is. This is a really big issue. And to the point that, you know, all of a sudden things have changed, I think we've had more time to understand or maybe be more confused about what this change may or may not do. And so if this bill will, what is the solution to decreasing or even eliminating sexual harassment in the workplace? And if that's what we really want to get at, I'm not sure that this is the solution, because I think it has to be broader than just this. I think it has to be policy, and it has to be another way of holding some of these businesses accountable so they can have the opportunity to do the right thing. And so I'm not sure that what this move is, what this amendment does, is going to solve the problem that we're experiencing. And so I had a question. Somebody brought up Delaware before. What did Delaware do? They seem to be satisfied with what Delaware did. I don't know what Delaware did. I just think this needs to be looked at in a very serious way. I don't want to be sexually harassed. I want my daughter to be sexually harassed. But I also have a son and a husband, and I don't want them to be falsely accused or just there's an allegation because it offended somebody. This is serious business. And so I'll go ahead and offer my amendment. I don't know if you're the one testifier that mentioned Delaware, if she wants to answer that question really quickly before I offer the amendment. Mr. Chair, that's up to you.
Chair Scott, who did you want to answer that question?
The testifier came up to the table.
Ms. Engelmeyer.
I had a quick answer.
Oh, there you are, right there.
Go ahead, Ms. Engelmeyer. Unfortunately, it's not a quick answer. What Delaware did is specifically do what Minnesota did in 1982, put a definition of what harassment is into the statute.
Okay. And so, thank you. And so why don't we look at that and see if it's something that works for us. And anyway, the amendment addresses the issue in that under number 3, and it removes, it takes the word or, changes it to and, so that there's a bit of a higher standard than just an offensive comment being grounds to bring a lawsuit. And so that's my amendment, and I would ask for members' support.
Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 10, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
No. Motion fails. The bill is not amended. Any other closing comments?
I'll be brief.
What is this? Is this a question or a statement?
It's a comment. Mr. Chair, just a comment.
Go ahead.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I was present at the testimony last year, and I want to start by just apologizing to Minnesotans that we didn't get this across the finish line last year. This had broad bipartisan support, and now all of a sudden we no longer have that. So I want to apologize to every Minnesotan that has been sexually harassed that we weren't able to get this addressed last year. What some of our testifiers fail to understand here is that it's not the settlement that they're after. They're seeking justice for being sexually harassed at work. Justice is what this bill does. This one sentence change is so elegant in its simplicity of making it so clear now in terms of what this new standard needs and has to be. I was supportive of this last year, and I wholeheartedly support this bill this year as well, and I am hopeful that we can move forward with this and get this approved. Sexual harassment has always been bad for business and will continue to be bad for business. If businesses take reasonable action to combat sexual harassment in the workplace, they have no reason to be concerned about this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Are there any members of the public who are here that want to be heard on House File 10? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, after we had that conversation about reasonable person standard and totality of circumstances and realizing Ms. Mullen's testimony to us or explanation to us that it hinges on the author's intent, I was just hoping that the author would explain her intent for those two standards.
So The question. I'm sorry. The question is to the author.
The question is
there
to
we
the
go.
Author.
Go ahead.
So that she can clarify her.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, thank you for that excellent question and for the opportunity here to clarify. It is my intention with this bill that we maintain the totality of the circumstances test. It is my intention with this bill that we maintain the reasonable person standard. And it is also my intention with this bill that we don't change any of the case law related to remedial action taken by employers. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I'm just actually following up on Representative O'Neill because I was going to ask the same question, and I so appreciate you bringing this up, and I've enjoyed working with you, Representative Mueller, and I do think this is still a bipartisan issue. I'm new, maybe I'm naive, but I think it is. I think we all want justice for victims, and we all want workplaces that are free of harassment. So with that being said, Representative Mueller, I also wondered if you would be willing to consider and just think about specifying that language about the employer knew or should have known of the harassment in question and failed to take proper remedial action. If we could put that in the statute or put the reasonable person or totality in the statute rather than just relying on intent, I think that provides the court much more clarity. And I just wondered, you know, if you'd be willing to entertain that further in the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins. I do appreciate that question, and I am willing to work on additional language. I will say that since this bill was dropped in the first week, I've had a number of groups come to me wanting different language. Nobody has actually proposed, none of these groups, and I appreciate that Chair Scott did give me some language, and also I talked to Representative O'Neill about a language, but none of the groups that are here today in opposition have actually given me any proposed language, and I have said all along that I'm definitely open to looking at some additional language or some change in language.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like a roll call on the bill.
Roll call has been asked for. Any closing comments, Representative Mueller?
Mr. Chair and members, I just really appreciate the thoughtful questions today. Do want to remind you all again, as you know, this was bipartisan bill supported last year, and we've had another year now to consider it. It's time for Minnesota to act. I request that you vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Mueller. And before we take the roll, I would note that members of the committee, of the folks who voted for this on the floor last year, Lesh, Carlson, Liebling, Mariani. That's four DFLers, Scott, Barr, Grossel, Johnson, Lucero, O'Neill. That's six Republicans. Committee CLA will take the roll.
Chair Lesh?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Mueller, I'm sorry. Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Barr? Representative Cantrell?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Considine?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Hassan?
Yes and yes.
Representative Herr?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Lucero? Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Moore?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Robbins?
Yes.
Representative Zhang?
Yes.
On a vote of 16 in favor and 0 against, motion passes. The bill is sent to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Did you have a comment?
Chair Lesh, I did vote for this bill, but I do trust that the author will work with the groups and try to make this a better bill, addressing some of the current concerns that we have, because it's an issue that we do need to address, but I just want to make sure that all parties are involved, and they do have a say in working together.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. What do we have on tomorrow?
It's nothing yet. Tuesday.
Oh, Tuesday. Okay, members, on Tuesday we have 7:45, eliminating provisions allowing marriages by minors, and 6:31. Oh, that's my tracking warrant spill. Oh, joy. Okay, Representative Considine.
Quick clarification. I must have been absent, or I'd have been on that yes vote from last year.
You must have been, because you were not. But there were two votes, Representative Considine. I know this was the only one I had was on my motion, and then I know that that she offered it again as a standalone bill, and that was a separate vote, but I just didn't have that. So
Yeah, you might have been gone. Sorry. Anyway, there being no other business before the committee is adjourned.